This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
And welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm relieved. No more voices, Sam. What's going on?
I was hoping you were going to notice that. Well, what's your actual name? If this is anyone's first episode, which I'm sorry, 7 seconds in.
Hey, y'all. I'm Jason.
This is Jason Moitoso. That is over there.
Yeah.
Across the virtual table and the literal table is Jason Moitoso. I, as you can tell, have resumed my professional cadence. I have put away the things of the past, the past, the childish actions of sounding like a Scottish Dracula
of yesteryear,
and perhaps in time the good Count McDracul will return. But for now,
let's keep him back in the crypt.
We're getting back to the facts. We're getting back to what we think the facts might be in some situations, and that of course means that I'm definitely not going to do any funny voices this episode.
I don't believe you.
Because let's introduce it right off the bat. Let's just do it.
We're talking about the
Flying Dutchman, matey. Oh, arr. Is that a pirate? What's a pirate? Give me a pirate. Arr, it's a Flying Dutchman, and I've got a bit of cheese.
What? Why does he have cheese?
Many's the night I dream of a bit of cheese. Huh? Treasure Island is about pirates.
Treasure Island is a fictitious story.
About pirates.
I understand that.
And that's like where so many of our pirate ideas and pirate aphorisms come from. And there's that part where he talks about dreaming of cheese toasted and all of that.
If I was a pirate, I'd be dreaming of, I don't know, oranges.
To keep away scurvy. You're just anti-scurvy, aren't you?
Yes. Who would be pro-scurvy?
It's such an outdated position. You're stuck in 1505.
I'm really, really concerned with who that person is. decrepit with a sign. Makes you strong, matey.
So, yes, we are here because instead of doing some hard-hitting factual research, I wanted to stay...
when have we done that?
Hard-hitting, relatively factual research.
Okay, that's fair.
I wanted to stay in the spooktacular forum for just one more week. I just didn't want to come back to the nitty-gritty. And you know what? Strangely enough, I started researching the Flying Dutchman literally with like the idea in my mind that, oh, this will be like a fun episode that means nothing and everybody's going to know it's nonsense. But I actually came away from this believing a little more in the Flying Dutchman than I anticipated that I would be.
What?
So, yeah.
Impossible.
And, of course, Jason's going to be here to balance that out. But it's actually quite the story. So before we get started here, Jason, you got anything you want to say?
No, I'm really confused. What do we have to do before we get started?
Well, I just want to do a few quick things.
Yeah. Run through it.
We just want to thank again everybody who submitted their stories to our listener special last week. It was a great time. People don't seem to have been too upset by the fact that it was 3 hours long. Some people actually said that they were glad it was 3 hours long. And like, I don't even know how you get to that point in your life, but okay. And I appreciate you. And to stand by what I subtitled the episode, y'all do have some problems, but I love hearing about your problems. So I'm actually what I'm going to do, and I'm not going to announce this every episode, but I'll bring it in from time to time. I'm going to keep that email account open, and not that I was going to close it anyway, but I'm going to keep the notalonepodstories@gmail.com open to receive stories all year round. And then that way I can kind of build them up and I can let you know at that point, you know, yeah, we might use this next time or no, it's just not the right fit. So if you missed out, because I had, even though we announced it for a few weeks ahead of time, I posted about it on Facebook, I posted about it on Twitter, we still had people say that they wish they had known sooner or that they missed out. So I'm telling you now, just send your stories to notalonepodstories@gmail.com. And who knows, maybe it won't be another year before the next one. Maybe we'll do one sooner. But in any case, we want to thank everyone who submitted a story there. And I want to give you all a recommendation. I've talked about them on the show before, but if you really enjoyed hearing those personal stories, I cannot recommend highly enough the Monsters Among Us podcast, which is one of our Dark Myths brothers, essentially. And it is all listener-submitted stories all week, every week. And they're, like, we had some genuine or genuinely terrifying and, like, creepy and weird and unexplainable stories, but they just go into overload. I mean, it's doppelgangers and mirror men and skinwalkers every week, all week. So, like, go check out the Monster Among Us podcast. You'll love it, I promise. The other thing that I wanted to call out really quick is, before I forget, almost all of the, especially the personal experiences that we're going to be drawing from for this week's episode, come from a website called anomalyinfo.com, which is the passion project of an individual named Garth Haslam. I've never met Garth. I've never talked to him in real or virtual life, but I do frequent his site quite often. I actually donate to him on Patreon because I think that he does an amazing job of finding genuine, at least mostly credible accounts. You know, the nice thing about this website is that it's not like, and I just want to point out that this is not a paid ad. Like, this is just me talking about it. It's not like other sites where they're like, oh, this story comes from Bob and Bob did this. What Garth will do is, like, people say this story came from Bob, but then I looked and it actually came from two other people before Bob, and then Bob added this and changed it. And, like, that is the kind of wonderful research that Garth puts into this. So,
man, is that what happens when you get to the second page of Google?
Pretty much. That's what it is. Is you just got to keep going through.
Yeah, keep going further. I mean, once you get to the second page, you're real desperate.
And we've used, I don't think I called them out last time, but we've used anomaly-ish info, especially on, like, our spontaneous human combustion. That's one of his, like, favorite phenomena, so it's a great resource for that. But anybody who is interested in the paranormal, especially if you're another individual who has a paranormal podcast, like, this is a fantastic resource. So go to anomalyinfo.com. And if you like them, I mean, go support them on Patreon. I think they only have a $1 level. So, like, you can spare a dollar for this good of research. But in any case, oh, and we also want to thank everybody who donates to our Patreon. And, like, I hope you all enjoyed the bonus episode of the humanoid encounters. It still is causing me to not be able to sleep every night. So thanks. I hope it's worth it.
I'm like a baby.
Jason's fine. But anyway, I hope you all enjoyed that as well. And ideally, we'll have a lot more bonus content coming at you more frequently and at shorter intervals soon. So, all right. Okay. With all of that out of the way, thank you for indulging me.
What are we talking about again?
Today, we are talking about the Flying Dutchman, mighty. Is that how you... How does a pilot...
A pilot?
How does a pilot talk? That's what I wanted to talk to you about.
Pilots?
We'll talk about it in the debrief.
Are we shooting a pilot?
There is something weird going on over our collective TV houses. Show no, I'm going to tell you what's going on in our skies above us, but we'll talk about that in the debrief. How does a pirate talk?
I don't know, Sam. I'm not immortal. I just want to be. I feel like it has to be really, like,
it's got to be growly, guttural and yeah. Anyway, so I guess I just
all that salt.
I guess I just won't do it. And really,
thank goodness,
the Flying Dutchman is not actually a pirate tale. It's gotten that association primarily, especially recently, from the Pirates of the Caribbean.
Because we've romanticized pirates so heavily.
Yeah, and taken away all of the rape and murder. So pirates aren't great, guys. Pirates are bad. Pirates are bad things. So even Jack Sparrow was a bad person. Maybe? I don't know.
He was just extremely lucky.
That's true. In any case, the legend of the Flying Dutchman does not begin with pirates. It begins with the rise of, again, something that you're going to recognize probably from Pirates of the Caribbean, the Dutch East India Trading Company, or the Dutch East Indies Trading Company, which was pretty much the first global superpower mega corporation. It was essentially an amalgamation of all these different little shipping companies that Holland then stepped in and was like, guess what? You're the same company now. And they're like, what? And then he's like, yeah. He being the personification of Holland is like, yeah. So.
All right, Sam. I think we should probably tone it down a little bit with these
with the accents. No. So the Dutch East Indies Company, which I am now from this point onwards going to abbreviate as DEIC, it was formed is the correct way of saying that word, in 1602, and it was a global superpower up until 1799.
So the Dutch government just created a monopoly?
Yes.
Did they own it? Was it technically theirs, or was it independent? Was it private?
The really cool thing about the DEIC is that it was essentially an arm of Holland, of the Dutch government. And so the DEIC would go out and found colonies and instill governors in the colonies under the flag of that corporation. But like, it all traces back to Holland itself. And this is just a very brief overview. I think one of my of our Dark Myths friends told me that either Stuff You Should Know or Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, one of those two podcasts, did a few episodes, I think, at least on the Dutch East India Trading Company. So, or the Dutch East India Company. So if you want to learn more about their history, go back and listen to that, because it's really, truly fascinating stuff. But for the setting here, all you need to know is that it's a monopoly. They had a complete monopoly of the spice trade for 21 years. And then even then, after that period,
that's enough time to get filthy rich.
Oh yeah. No one else could compete with them in any aspect, but you still had other people breaking into it from here or there.
Okay. So we have a very well-established business and an empire based off of import and export.
Exactly. Right? It's a shipping. It's so a trading. Where
are we going then?
Well, what we see is that the Flying Dutchman is completely and totally connected with the Dutch East India Company. Yes.
Weird.
They are
crazy.
They are the same. Not all the way the same, but it's likely that the oral legend of the Dutchman has been around for at least 100 years longer than the first written account. Okay, the first written account comes to us by a man named John MacDonald in 1790. Now, he wrote this in a bit of printed material called Travels in Various Parts of Europe, Asia, and Africa during a series of 30 years and upward. It's a thrilling, thrilling title for a thrilling book, I am sure. The actual tradition, however, or the actual superstition of the Flying Dutchman most likely originates from the center of the 1600s. So like I said, at least 100, probably 120 or so years earlier.
Okay, however, so it was just an old sailor's tale before this. Essentially?
Kind of.
Sort of?
Yeah, it was an oral tradition more than anything. It was just told from sailor to sailor. But as we'll talk about here in a moment, it's not an old sailor's tale in the idea that it's completely foundless. It's that it's just baseless.
Do you think it took so long to get written down by just like, are sailors not very educated at that time point?
I'm not too sure. I don't know that they're particularly concerned with
literacy.
Yeah, it's just not. You always read.
I mean, I'm
like,
sure, like the captain and a few quartermasters and stuff like that.
Yeah, but like in old books, like people being able to read was special, and
right,
like
right.
Sailors,
and it's something I take for granted now, which is why I ask if it's just like a ship hand tale or if it's something
rough
else.
And tumble types also are always depicted as like readings for nerds and I'm a sailor. And so I don't know, maybe it's a literacy thing. Maybe it's just that they don't want to, because they're superstitious, of course. Like that's pretty well known. So perhaps you have this sort of effect of if we talk about it or if we write it down, it's going to bring it upon us, or that sort of a thing. That's, you know, superstition takes many forms. But for whatever reason, this original account comes from a man who I don't believe was a contracted sailor. He was simply a traveler. Not much is known about him, though, this John MacDonald. But what he
says...
Yeah,
it's a pretty common name there, isn't it? Yeah.
What he says, published in the 1790 publication, is, quote, "The weather was so stormy that the sailors said they saw the Flying Dutchman. The common story is that this Dutchman came to the Cape in distress of weather and wanted to get into harbor, but could not get a pilot to conduct her, and was lost. And that ever since, in very bad weather, her vision appears. Now, in this account, we have a reference to the Cape. The Cape here is the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa, which was just a couple of hundred years before this known as the Cape of Storms. This Cape is a point in South Africa commonly incorrectly believed to be the southernmost tip of Africa. However, what it actually is the point in which a ship traveling towards Asia, and India specifically for the Dutch East India Company, specifically, it was this point where it started to turn more eastward than it did southward. So it's essentially the point where you round the bend.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the Cape of Good Hope, and we're moving forward, and we're changing directions, and it's so good. But there's, in reality, it's just a terrible place
there's
storm
a lot of
all the time.
Great white sharks in South Africa. So.
Sure, I believe it. And it's also, I believe, the point where the Atlantic and like Indian Oceans meet. And so you have a lot of weird pressure systems, and I don't know how climate and weather works, but it's terrible.
It's interesting that you bring that up.
Oh, do you?
Yes.
Do you want to talk about it now?
Nope.
Okay. Well,
just
Jason's
remember
prepared.
Everyone.
There we go.
I'm semi prepared.
Now, as you might imagine, for a company that makes its bread and butter going the long way to Asia by sea.
Well, I mean, they didn't have it any other way at this point.
No,
time,
not
right?
by sea.
Yeah.
Like, you could have walked it, but you just can't. You can't. It's just not efficient.
Right.
Like,
right.
On a caravan load size.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure on a boat, you could probably haul a lot more.
A whole lot more. So many boats full of gold and treasure and mainly spices.
No, they're not the Spanish.
They're not Spanish galleons coming from New America, New Spain, New España. It frequently traveled as part of pretty much every voyage was this rounding of the Cape of Good Hope for anyone involved in the DEIC. Now, the Dutchman, however, the legend grows and goes, is that it was more than just some, and I kind of reference this, supernatural apparition. It was more than just something that may have been occurring for a very long time, and so a legend was brought up to explain it. We see this sort of things sometimes when you have ideas like ball lightning and stuff like that, where this is a natural phenomena that happens, and then a folklore of goblins and ghosts and
right,
aliens.
Right, because we don't have the science yet to explain.
Exactly, grow up around it. As far as we can tell, this is not necessarily the case of the Flying Dutchman, because it's something that's peculiar and specific after the start of the DEIC, and especially one incident that took place in 1641.
And I want to make sure before we jump in this, I've got this completely correct.
Yes.
They are the sole company sending ships through that system? Or is this a highly trafficked route by other nations as well?
The monopoly existed for a time. The monopoly
okay.
was eventually broken.
That was the 21 year mark or whatever?
Yeah, and I don't know what 21
just
years
Dutch
it was.
Ships?
Yeah, okay. But they were the only ones transporting spices, as far as I know.
Is that from military control or?
Probably,
purely
because
economic.
they were military as well.
I mean,
they were a military
yes.
arm, they were a political arm, they were everything for that empire.
Exactly.
It's like a
They're
shadow
empire,
really. You don't think of it as a normal empire, but it totally was.
Right. I mean, it feels like they have more finesse.
Yes, exactly.
It's deals in the back room versus at sword point.
Yes, most likely. In any case, yeah, it's something peculiar to that, but it's not something that is only seen by members of that, as we'll see here shortly. Now, what can be found as a quote-unquote genesis or starting point for the legend of the Flying Dutchman is a historical fact, is one situation which, like I mentioned, took place in 1641, and it has to do with the sinking of a ship. The ship's name is unknown, as far as we can tell, and that ship was captained by a man named Hendrik van der Decken. Now, this is the name of the captain of of what we commonly think of as the Flying Dutchman. However, other people say that the Flying Dutchman is the captain. He is the Dutchman that's being ascribed to there. However, we don't know. And well, honestly,
with the myth so old, I'm sure it's told both ways.
Exactly, it is.
It's synonymous with one another.
And the actual truth of the situation, as far as truth can be, may be that the Flying Dutchman is truly an amalgamation of the two. The ship can't be separated from the captain, and the captain can't be separated from the ship. That sort of an idea. So the story goes that he makes it to India, as okay. he's done before. Fills
okay,
up.
Okay, so we have a seasoned sailor.
Yes,
captain and whatnot.
He's not a greenie or whatever. Seasoned guy. Makes it to India and fills up his hole full of seasonings and spices and all sorts of wonderful, precious things. And then he makes the long ride back home. And as he approaches this cape, he thinks to himself, man, it would sure be, and he's thinking out loud, man, it would sure be nice if the DEIC would just go ahead and establish some sort of a colony here or some sort of a overland route. Maybe this could be a base of operations. And then we wouldn't have to deal with all this crappy weather and going around it and this and that. He's just talking. But what it betrays is this idea that he's turning for the first time away from just like, oh, the way things are. And he's thinking about like, oh, the way things should be. And I think that's the real significance of him voicing this around aloud in the legend, because that particular detail has survived through time. Now, as he actually gets up on the cape, as is wont to do, he notices a sudden and vicious storm descend. And it begins to rack the ship. And everybody's saying, okay, we know how this goes. We've done this at least a few times before. There's a terrible storm. We pull into the cape, and then we pull out of the cape, and we go forward. But they're kind of confused, as they are given no orders other than straight forward into the storm. And they approach Captain Hendrick, and they say, what's going on here? Like, this is dangerous. This is a life-threatening situation. You're on a deadline, sure, but it's not that... It's not a day-by-day deadline. Like, we can wait overnight. It's going to be fine. And the captain seemed to be different. Some people said that he was drunk. Some people said that he had gone mad. But what I really think it comes down to is that he had grown weary of being subject not only to the company itself, but to the sea, and particularly this Cape of Storms around the Cape of Good Hope. And he had just gotten fed up that every single time he had to yield to the sea, and he was not having it. So he conveys this one way or the other, according to legend. Mainly you don't have that idea of him fighting against it. You just have the idea that he's drunk, primarily, or just angry, and just a real tight ass who really wants to get things done on time, sort of a thing. And so he swears an oath. He swears an oath and a blasphemy, saying that, set me against God, I will beat this. I will not stop for anything. We are making it through this storm. His exact words at one point is that even if it takes me until doomsday, I will defeat this storm and this cape. And this ended up being pretty much the opposite of the reassurance that the crew had been hoping for. Maybe they thought that he just hadn't realized what was going on, but it became very apparent to them that he was in complete control of his senses of what was happening. At the very least, he knew where he was taking his men. And they wasted almost no time in mutinying. And Hendrick responded by losing absolutely no time in killing the would-be captain of the who meant to replace him, if the mutiny was successful, and threw his body into the sea. And this is where something really, I just love this aspect, because it's magical. The body hits the sea. And the moment that it does, this is an old wooden ship, quote Anchorman. The moment that it hits the sea, this old wooden ship, which has been creaking and groaning and moaning and shifting upon the sea, suddenly this creaking and groaning and moaning starts to form words. And suddenly the ship is talking to Captain Van der Decken. And the words that are said is, "Do you truly mean to sail through the night, forsaking the port in the storm?" And Henrik screamed back, partially directed at the ship, partially directed up towards God himself, looking down on the whole affair, and repeated his initial vow, but with a conditional, or an additional condition, in which he says, "May I be eternally damned if I do stop, if I do pull into port. May I be eternally damned, though I shall beat about here till the end of judgment, or till the day of judgment," which reminds me a lot of that line in Pirates of the Caribbean when Barbossa says to Jack Sparrow, and he says, "So what now? Are we to be two immortals locked in an epic battle until judgment day and trumpets sound?" And that was like the tightest line I had ever heard in my 12-year-old life. I loved that line so much.
Sam, are we talking about the Flying Dutchman, so just so you can talk about Pirates of the Caribbean?
It does come up quite a bit.
Yeah, a few times already.
When Pirates of the Caribbean was in theaters, I didn't want to go see it because
it looked scary.
It looked scary.
It looked scary.
And I knew there were skeletons in it, underwater skeletons, and I was not
a fan. That's scary.
Yeah. And now I am I am quite sad that I never saw it in theaters because that probably would have been an awesome experience.
It was good.
I remember specifically, I think it was my older brother, Jake. It may have been my other older brother, Ben, who it was like their birthday and they wanted so bad to go see it. And I was like, "I'm not doing it. Nope, I'm not doing it." When did that movie come out? So Pirates of the Caribbean came out in 2003. So we were in third grade. I was 9 years old. Like,
that sounds about right.
I was scared of the Pirates of the Caribbean, and now I am sad that I did not go. But anyway, that line.
I'm sad that remaining movies weren't good.
The second one, which is the one about the Flying Dutchman, was pretty good. The Dead Man's Chest.
You mean Davy Jones?
And the Flying Dutchman.
Was the ship the Flying Dutchman?
That was the ship.
Oh, okay.
It's his ship.
Okay.
Yeah. That's not canon in the legend.
Yeah.
Davy Jones doesn't have anything to do with the Flying Dutchman, but it was dope. And Bill Nye played a great Nye, not Nye, Nye, N-I-G-H-Y.
Okay.
He is the one who did the acting for the Flying Dutchman, or for the Davy Jones, but okay. In any way.
I wonder how well that CGI like holds up today.
We could watch right now.
No.
Take a 2-hour break.
Another time.
That's fair. So he responds and in the affirmative. I'm going to do it no matter what.
Okay.
The ship then replies, again, this groaning and moaning and scraping. And it says, "As a result of your actions, you are condemned to sail the seas for eternity with a ghostly crew of dead men, bringing death to all who sight your spectral ship, and to never make port or know a moment's peace. Furthermore, gall shall be your drink and red-hot iron your meal." But Henrik even then did not waver. He didn't show a moment's hesitation as he yelled back, "Amen to that." And at that moment, quite unnaturally, the Dutchman was not sunk in the traditional idea of the weather got really bad, it capsized, it splintered, this or that. The Dutchman sunk because a portal opened in the sea and swallowed it whole. And took,
just like Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yes, exactly. It took everything with it. Now, the Dutchman and its legends was cited a number of times in different publications as the legend of the ship grew. It's captain.
Before we get too much further.
Okay.
I just want to take a second and talk about that story for a moment.
Yes. Please.
Does that
I love that story so much.
Does that not just sound like a sailor's tale to teach you not to go against what you have been taught?
Yeah, totally.
Is it not just a lesson? Is it just not like, this is what happens when you poke the boogeyman? Like, that's what this is.
Oh, yeah. 100%. I agree.
Okay.
But the historical record shows that Captain Hendrik van der Decken did sink in 1641.
Okay.
Like, that's what's interesting about it, is that, yes, you're completely right. I agree with you 100%.
Do you think it's embellishment on that tale?
Oh, probably. I don't think that the actual boat started talking to him.
Well, neither do I, but...
Well, obviously you don't, because you never would.
Of course.
I might, In this case, it pains me to say that I don't.
I'm just saying that Shipp has a wide vocabulary.
It's just so such beautiful imagery.
It's fantastic. It really is. I want a mini series on HBO for it.
Yes. Oh, we could do it. We could do it.
We can't. HBO can.
Anyway, I think I told you in the spontaneous human combustion, doing that research made me want to make a movie wherein there's an old sea captain on a ship in a foggy night, and he's walking about the deck when one of his crewmen just spontaneously combusts and is like frozen on the deck burning to death. I think that would be an amazing opening to a series. And what better series than The Legend of the Flying Dutchman? We'd just call it The Dutchman. But then that could be easily confused with people from Holland. So
that's fair.
In any case, yeah, no, I agree with you 100%.
Okay.
It's totally this is why you respect the sea, laddie.
Yeah.
That sort of
and
a thing.
And this is why you don't go against what the Dutch East India Company tells you to do.
Yes. You never mutiny. You never, yeah, there's a 100 good morals here.
Yeah, the rage that you evoke.
Exactly. And, okay. And what you see is that this legend, that legend I just told you.
I'm sure there's several different variations
exactly.
of that all over the world.
What I just told you is
with different sailors.
Pretty much almost, it's the penultimate version of the legend. The
okay.
second to last iteration. The original one is just that Captain Vanderdecken or someone was lost at sea, and then their ghostly ship remained sailing the ocean forevermore. And it moves and it grows. And what's interesting is that you can see this happen throughout literature. There's a motif of punishment that gets applied, especially during the end of like the 1700s and beginning of the 1800s, where it no longer just becomes that he was a ship trying to do its best and got swallowed up, but this idea of like hubris and going against
right.
God in the sea. This is a later development of the story for sure. You have the idea that not only was the captain a criminal, but you also get the idea that the sailors themselves and every member of the crew was guilty of some terrible crime, either the mutiny itself, which even if your captain is taking you into the depths of hell, like a mutiny is still a mutiny. Especially back in those days, like even now, a mutiny is treason. And so it's totally there to instill values, and these values come throughout the ages. Other sources like Sir Walter Scott, a very prolific Scottish writer, he recast the Dutchman as pirates and ascribed to it the undesirable behavior of pirates. And that's why it sank. That's why it's cursed. However, after the shuttering of the company at the turn of the 19th century, the legend of the Dutchman, which went from being a curiosity of a mariner, or maybe some people who really wanted to go out and see the world, like your Sir Walter Scotts and your travelers and people like that, it went from being just something that those kinds of people knew about to being published in travel journals, being published in books and literature much more often. But the eventual thing that solidified it is in folklore forever is twofold. The first is a magazine that was known as Blackwood's Edinburgh Magazine, which is a British publication of miscellaneous things, because technically it's like miscellany, but I don't know how to say that. So no?
Okay. I'm fine with miscellaneous things.
Miscellaneous things. And it served as a platform for criticisms and reviews, but it also was a creative forum for poetry and especially spooky stories.
Oh, it's like a blog.
Yeah, pretty. It's a walk and talk and blog.
I thought.
Yeah, back in the 1800s. And it specifically influenced writers like Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, the Bronte sisters. And in 1821, a story of the Dutchman was published there. And it's that story that I just told you. That is that penultimate.
That's the one that circulates.
Yes, that's the one that circulates that gets everywhere. However, the final version of this story comes, and the most important version and enduring version.
Yeah, from SpongeBob.
Yes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It comes from a opera. An opera that was composed by...
I wouldn't call SpongeBob an opera.
It's very tragic, and they sing a lot, and who knows?
You're not wrong there, actually.
An opera that was written and composed by the master musician Richard Wagner, which premiered in 1843. Now, if you doubt that an opera can solidify the public image of folklore for hundreds of years to come, I'd like to remind you all that it was Wagner's opera, which was based on the Norse cycles and the Norse sagas and rings. That's why we think of Vikings with horned helmets. That idea had not come up until that opera, and then it shaped everything after it. So, like, it's totally possible.
Yeah, they didn't actually wear horns.
No, of course not. It's completely reasonable to say that without this opera, the Dutchman probably would have survived in some form, but it would not be a common
idea. Yeah, Bugs Bunny's cross-dressing into an opera singer is probably a little bit different.
Exactly. Now, what we see in this opera is that it itself was influenced by another publication. It was a novel called The Memoirs of Mr. von Schlanbolopsky. I'm not going to try it again. Nope, I'm not doing it again. Thank you. And this was written by a man named Heinrich Heine, published in 1833. This recounts Blackwood's article as gospel, but it does change and primarily add a few different things. The biggest change, which was made primarily to allow a greater plot to be infused in the story of the Flying Dutchman, was that the ship and its captain was allowed to make port and step on land once every 7 years. Now, if you'll remember, in the Pirates of the Caribbean, the Dutchman is allowed to step foot on land once every 10 years. I don't remember exactly what he does. It's something with his heart in a jar of dirt, that sort of a thing. Very good. But the primary cause for the Dutchman in these older novels and in Wagner's play, opera.
His heart was in a jar of dirt because he couldn't touch land. The dirt was symbolic for land.
Oh, interesting.
So he couldn't get to it. Man, how'd you... We got to watch. We got to watch Pirates 2 again.
We're going to watch them all. No. Thank you.
We'll stop at 2.
That's fair. And the idea, what the Dutchman does, which I know for a fact is not what he tries to do in Pirates of the Caribbean, is that he uses this one day in order to find redemption through the love of a woman. If he can get someone to love him, he will be redeemed, because that's like your good old fashioned. That's the bread and butter of fairy tale and good storytelling.
It's always
right there.
True love that fixes all the issues.
Exactly.
Interesting.
And this
one day
is he's single and sad.
Yeah.
As he takes a drink of beer. This is the story of Wagner's opera. Okay. The flying Dutchman, or its captain, or whatever, it gets to be that 7 year mark. And that very moment that he's allowed to touch land, I kid you not, he goes to the first middle age or older man that he sees and says, "Let me marry your daughter. Here's a big chest of gold." And the man's like, "Yeah. Yeah, this is a great idea."
I mean, that's what you do with daughters back in those days.
Exactly. And then through a series of comedy of errors-esque miscommunications, the Dutchman decides...
That's not true love or whatnot?
Well, basically, the girl was romantically involved with another man, but this was a while ago. The Dutchman overhears them talking... They're like talking about their past, but he perceives it to be their present. And so he says, "Well, it has to be true love. So this isn't going to work. I've wasted a day. I'll be back in 7 years." But here's what he doesn't know. And the audience does know this because it's addressed in Act One. What he doesn't know is that this girl, for whatever reason, off the coast of Norway, this girl knows very well the legend of the Flying Dutchman, and she has sworn to be the woman who loves him. and sworn to be the person who breaks the curse. So as the Dutchman sails away, she in desperation throws herself into the sea. And that's the act of true love. And the play ends, the opera ends with the Dutchman, the captain. So the ship, the captain, and the maiden being hoisted up into heaven to live forevermore.
What about the rest of the crew?
Who cares? They're not important. Opera is weird, for sure. But that is the final true iteration of the legend. Now, there's been adaptations. There's been adaptations out every single form of media this story has been adapted to, adding and taking away and this or that. But
look how many different adaptations there are of Frankenstein.
Oh, yeah.
Or even sticking with the pirate themes. Treasure Island.
Yeah.
We have Treasure Planet. Black Flags recently was produced and is with the same exact characters. It's a prequel for it.
There you go.
And like there's so many different retellings of similar tales.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's
there are no original thoughts.
No. Everything is recycled and don't even try to
except for Mickey Mouse. You can thank Disney for popular domain.
Yeah, because he just turned 90 years old, yeah. Like on Sunday, and they just keep changing the law.
Yeah.
In any case, the legend of the Dutchman has existed from that point onward, and it will exist for a very long time, I guarantee it. But there is some evidence, I don't know if I'll say evidence, there are some accounts that the Dutchman itself may be more than just a legend, than just the explanation for why a ship piloted by a skilled captain crashed and sunk, and why you shouldn't mutiny against people and all of that. The only other thing to be said about the legend of the Flying Dutchman actually goes back to the character of Captain Henrik himself. Now, while this is a person who was on the manifest, as sinking a ship and lost all the souls about the ship and committed to the deep and all of that, not much is actually known about him. What we do know is another figure who was involved, a sea captain employed by the Dutch East India Company, which is a man by the name of Bernard Falk.
Bernard.
Or Folk.
Okay. Okay.
Yes. And what makes Bernard...
How's it spelled?
F-O-K-K-E. Yeah.
It's me, man.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to avoid that explicit tag on iTunes, so we're just going to say Folk for now, because who knows?
Would it be explicit when we're trying to pronounce someone's name?
I think so. I feel explicit.
Ooh.
Now, this was a captain who was famous. He actually made the fastest transit between the Dutch Republic and Java.
12 parsecs, right?
Yes, exactly. And which is a route that went under and around the Cape of Good Hope. Now, Falk was said to have used iron yardarms instead of wood, which allowed him to remain with full sail. Like, it added stability to the sails, but it made it even more dangerous because if those break, now you have iron everywhere instead of just wood, and it weighs things down and this and that. But he was said to be incorrigible. He would put people's lives at risk to get there as fast as he could and as fast back. So what you have is this idea that this individual served as a template on which to project the character of Heinrich von Vanderdecken.
So he was just a loose cannon.
Exactly. And they both
he had it coming.
They both lived around the same time. He was born in 1600. His fastest time logged was in 1678. So he was sailing all of his life. And he was officially said to be lost
at sea.
Could
you imagine?
Yeah, no, I can't. To live on the ocean all of your life. That's terrible.
No, like getting your best time at 78?
Oh, yeah.
Like, oh, God.
You made it, though. Like, this is something you'd have to practice for years and years and years for. Eventually, he was said to be lost at sea, but not much is known about that either. It's just this idea that this other...
Well, 78, you can get confused.
Yeah. This other historical figure, who we do know more about, could have been back-painted as a template for the captain of the Dutchman.
Sure.
And those qualities. So that's pretty much the only last thing I have to say there on the legends department. And I just didn't feel right not putting it in. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a better way to find them. Something better than just posting your job online and praying for the right people to see it. Well, friends, ZipRecruiter knew that there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply for your job. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you receive so you never miss a great match. The right candidates are out there, and ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Now, businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, for free. Now, all you need to do is go to ZipRecruiter.com/alone. That's ZipRecruiter.com/alone. I'm going to spell it for you. ZipRecruiter.com/alone alone. And again, you're going to be able to use ZipRecruiter for free. So, ZipRecruiter.com/alone. It's ZipRecruiter. The smartest way to hire.
So upset.
Why are you upset?
I was waiting for the perfect moment to quote the Flying Dutchman from SpongeBob.
Oh no!
And I did not find it.
If you want, give me a quote and I will sew it in somewhere.
What a night. Crew, howl with me so we might set the seas ablaze with fear.
Oh! Yes. Okay. And
that's all I needed.
All right. We do have some quote unquote real life accounts of the Dutchman. And this is where the good work over at anomalyinfo.com really comes in. All of these reports were taken from there. So the earliest account of the Dutchman was that of a man by the name of George Barrington. Now, this took place sometime between 1790 and 1792. The reason that we know this took place in 1790 and 1792 is because the good man Barrington was on the voyage of a lifetime being transported as a criminal to Australia.
Oh, so he's a bad boy.
Yes, back when we used to do that.
We didn't. No, I didn't do that.
Yeah, they used to do that. Those heartless British. But it's quite an interesting punishment scheme, if you think about
it. Well, everything in Australia wants to kill you.
Exactly. So.
I'm not surprised.
Now, Barrington was a notorious pickpocket, and he was so severe a repeat offender that just 2 years after the British established a colony in New South Wales, which is the southeastern state of Australia, Barrington was not so gently invited to participate in the good work of making the land habitable and then living there forever so that at the very least he would stop robbing people in London. Even if he just went on to robbing people in New South Wales.
He's your problem now.
Exactly. Now, he was determined.
That's the way to do it.
Get out of my
sight. That's how an empire does it.
Pretty much. He was determined to make the absolute best of a bad situation, and he wrote a few different volumes of his experiences. They were moderately successful, but the part of writing that sticks around the most is a quatrain that served as a prologue to one of his works. And it is as follows. From distant clime, or well-spread sea, we come. Though not with much a clat or beat of drum, true patriots all, for let it be understood, we left our country for our country's good. And
He's a poet.
That. Yeah, kind of, in his own way. And
in a
that,
sense.
That line, we left our country for our country's good, is somewhat, especially in like a counterculture sort of way, somewhat of a motto of Australia. Is it's been used in as preface to books and movies and all sorts of things, and it's just this beautiful idea of
it,
like,
is a good setup.
It's amazing.
It's a great setup to start a story.
It is. It's fantastic. But his works are notable as well for being, again, like I said, the earliest actual sighting of the Dutchman. Now, we had from John MacDonald, also in 1790, we had the first published account of the existence of the Dutchman, but it was basically just to say some sailors believe in these sorts of things. However, when Barrington was on his way to Australia, he recounts this story for the uninitiated reader, talking about the story of the Dutchman itself and of the souls lost and all of this and that. But he makes sure that the reader knows that he doesn't particularly believe it. Now, during the voyage itself, he's sleeping. It's 2 a.m. For some reason, he's been trusted with the liquor cabinet key. I don't know why.
Well, was he trusted by it? Because, I mean, if he's a pickpocket...
That's true.
Although, if he's a well-known pickpocket, he's probably not very good at it.
No. If you're a famous smuggler, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I'm getting at.
Exactly.
Maybe he was not as good as he thought he was.
Exactly. It could be. And that's the thing, is that either way, people knew he had this liquor key, this key to the cabin.
He's got a key.
He's got the key. And this leads to the boatswain coming in at 2 a.m, waking him up hysterical. Just hysterical. He said that he was in the dear need of a drink as he had just seen the Flying Dutchman itself. Now, according to the sailor, and I'm going to quote here, "I was just looking over the weather bow. What should I see but the Flying Dutchman coming right down upon us with everything set. I know 'twas she. I could see all her lower deck ports up, and the lights fore and aft as if cleared for action. Now as how, do you see, I am sure that no mortal ship could bear her lower deck ports up and not founder in this here weather. Why, the sea runs mountains high. It must certainly be the ghost of that there Dutchman that foundered in this latitude, and which I have heard say always appears in this here quarter in hard gales of wind." And of course, the setting for this story was as they rounded the Cape of New Hope in, or a Cape of, not a New Hope, a Cape of Good Hope in this terrible sort of a storm. And Barrington didn't believe this, but he gave the man a drink of liquor anyway, and then he went above board to check it out. There was one other person on board at this time. They did not see the ghost ship. They did not see anything. And Barrington finally came away and said, "Well, it's stormy, it's cloudy, it's foggy. Most likely, what this young man saw, or old man, I don't know, was illuminated sea beings, not beings, animals, creatures, not mermaids, illuminated sea creatures in these high mountain-like waves through the fog." Because the main point that he says is that he sees the lights of the ship off in the fog. That's essentially what he's trying to say through all of that old-timey speech. He sees the light, and the light could not be in the location it was in if it was a normal ship. And so, therefore, it had to be the Flying Dutchman. Now, I don't know if that's a great explanation. I don't know if that many illuminated sea creatures, and I don't know that they're going to shine so brightly.
It's the jellies, bro.
I guess.
I don't know.
We do have, I think, at least one marine biologist who listens to this podcast. So...
hit us up.
Hit us up. Let me know. I should have just emailed you first.
I know some things, but I don't know all the things.
No, he doesn't. But in any case, that's the first sighting. And it's dubious, for sure. It's secondhand, for sure, but it is the first time someone says, "This isn't just a legend, it's happening to me," as far as we can tell, or at least written down. Now, the other cool thing about Barrington, just as a quick aside, is that on this voyage, they decide to mutiny, which is not, as we've established, not a great thing to do. And Barrington knows.
It's an extreme.
It's an extreme. Barrington knows this, and instead of joining the mutiny, as people literally came to him and was like, "You're great at being a criminal, join our mutiny." And he was like, "Sure." And then he went to the captain and was like, "There's going to be a mutiny." And so as soon as he got to Australia, he became the first emancipated criminal and the first person who made it all the way to Australia and then was freed. And then he became like a governor.
Wow.
Yeah. He had a good, I think he was all pretty straight after that. I know, right? So snitches get governorships, I guess.
Cool.
Keep that in mind. Yeah. So that's Barrington. And that's the first opaque and archetypal sighting.
Yeah, but it also sounds like a lot of just suggestive thought.
Oh, totally. And that's another I mean, I can't fault you on that one because suggestive thought runs very well through this entire narrative.
And again, we're talking about people that are very superstitious because they are really just at the mercy of the sea and the elements, and they are all alone. Mm-hmm. It drives superstition.
Totally. Your eyes just did something crazy. Totally. I agree completely. Yeah, you're not going to hear any argument about that out of me. But one element of this story that's missing is that the reason that you're afraid of the Dutchman is that it's a portent of doom. But no doom came. Well, I guess the doom came to the people who tried to mutiny and then failed and then presumably were killed.
Right.
But no doom came to Barrington. No doom, as far as we know, came to that boatswain.
Well, Barrington didn't see it.
True. As far as we know, not to that boatswain either. However, the next sightings, though, are riddled with doom. And this one comes from 1842. It's really an interesting way that this came about, okay? It comes from 1842 between a two-month period reaching from September 10th to November 11th. And these stories surfaced in the September-October issue of the United States Naval Proceedings and in a September-October of 1915 issue of this publication. And it's told in letters between two distant relations of a man by the name of John A. Mudd, who was a paymaster. That was his official title in the Navy when he was part of the Navy.
He's the guy that wrote you all the checks?
Yes, as far as I know, yeah. Now, Mudd received these letters in a packet from, I believe it was his father, when he himself joined the Naval Academy, or right before he shipped off after graduating from the Naval Academy. And he didn't think to open them until he was actually on the high seas.
Of course not.
As he opens them and reads them, though, he realized that this is a packet of correspondence that takes place from the early 1940s and leads up through the Civil War up until
1940s.
Sorry, 1840s.
Okay,
my bad. And leads through the end of the Civil, or the at least part of the Civil War, when one of the two correspondents was killed in the war. It is a treasure trove of history and of correspondence between the two men. And one of the writers...
Ocean and the sea is probably not a great place to keep those documents.
Seriously, but that's what they decided to do.
Of course.
One of the writers of the letters, however, and both of them are going to be... they remain unnamed in both the publishing of the materials and the research that comes about after. So I'm going to name him Bud, because I don't want to just keep saying the unnamed writer. So we're going to call him Bud Mudd, because that's what I wish my parents had named me. Bud Mudd. Bud was a Navy lieutenant who was stationed on the African coast on a ship that Mudd had not wished to disclose. The first encounter that Bud had with the unknown was when the unnamed ship that was returning, that he was on, was returning to port, when suddenly a huge, what he took to be slaver, appeared out of the fog. It appeared with almost nowhere to go but into them. And he began to be extremely worried, as you would be, as you see this ship extremely close, extremely fast, coming extremely at you. But after just a moment, there was some sort of a flash of light, and then the ship was gone. It was as real as anything before him, but it disappeared, and no collision came. Now, this was worrisome, to be sure, but he kind of thought, you know what, maybe I was just hallucinating, because the weird thing about it is that the ship was sailing against the wind. It was sailing against the wind at an insane speed. Now, Bud had just kind of assumed that the ship had to have sunk, if it was real at all. Now, two nights later, in the midst of a lightning storm, a flash of light illuminated the area around the ship, and the lieutenant, once again, happening to be on deck at the time, once again spots this massive form of a great black ship. Its sails are full against the wind. This time it wasn't just Bud Mudd who saw it. It was everybody on the deck. Everybody on deck of this ship was yelling and screaming. It passed so close that again, everyone braced themselves for a collision. But this time, it didn't come right at them and disappear. It was just passing very close. And then it passed away. And then it disappeared. But it was once it was a little bit away from them. However, as it passed, they realized that the ship was in the dark, flying completely blind. There was no lights at all to be seen on the ship moving against them. Now, on the third and final appearance of the massive ghost ship, it was sighted again, this time during the day, drifting about the horizon and again sailing against the wind. However, suddenly, what appeared to be an extremely onset storm slapped the thing off the face of the ocean. That's the exact phrase that was used. Now, the crew made ready to receive the brunt of the storm, which had appeared to sink or elsewise transport the other ship, but it simply never came. The lieutenant claimed, however, that he was able to see by the aid of a spyglass that the windows of the ship had been broken, and it appeared completely empty inside.
Ooh. It's a ghost ship. It's traveling around. Crewless.
You'd think so.
On the currents.
You'd think so.
Okay.
However.
You ruined that theory, didn't you?
There's something more.
The account ruins the theory.
However, unlike in the previous case where, yeah, there was like an attempted mutiny. I don't even know if anyone got hung because I think they stopped it soon enough and whatever. In this case, the Dutchman's influence did continue to be felt after its disappearance. It did appear as a bad omen. Now, the reason... No, I already did that. Now, this unnamed ship, right, the one that Bud Mudd was on, the unnamed ship was in fact due for a spot of bad luck, a historically sized one. It would come to be found out. See, this unnamed ship has long since been named. In fact, it was named almost the moment that the article was published because it experienced something that no other United States Navy vessel before or after has experienced.
Teleportation?
A mutiny ending in the hanging of the offenders off the yardarms of the mast.
That's a little extreme.
It is a bit.
That's like witch trial-esque extreme.
Yeah, but it's a mutiny at sea.
Whatever happened to walk the plank?
Well, that's true. That'd be a good way of doing it. But no, and this is like the area up in the ship. There's actually an illustration of it. The flag's right there, and then right beneath the flag, three dead bodies.
Man, if you were a pirate ship,
yeah.
Oof. Yeah, that'd be cool.
That would be cool. But
that's
instead,
imagery right there.
You're a United States naval vessel. So that's not great. Now,
yeah, that's some bad PR right there, isn't it?
This whole mutiny affair is a pretty well-documented, like I said, it's an extremely unique occurrence. But in addition to that, the ship itself also found itself capsized and at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. Now, this ship was the USS Summers, and while it's worthy of its own entire episode of a different non-spooky podcast as an interesting failed experiment that led directly to the establishment of the Naval Academy, a la three dead mutineers hanging from the posts, it is a tale for another time. However, the tale of J.A. Mudd, the pay director, doesn't stop there with the tales of his distant relatives, because he had his own story of the Dutchman to tell, which took place some 30 years later, when Mudd was stationed on a ship all his own, in the employ of the United States Navy. Now, Mudd's ship was traveling along the western coast of Central America, and he had spent almost the entirety of the preceding morning and afternoon poring over the letters that he had received from his family before shipping out, something to remind him of the proud legacy of naval excellence that he was contributing to. But there was another legacy he would contribute to, and that is the proud and enduring legacy of seeing the Flying Dutchman right up in your face. Because, almost unbelievably, and this is one of those times where, like Jason just mentioned, you don't think that the location and the stories and this and that got to the people and it just caused them to be scared. I absolutely do. Because he literally spent all day reading stories about the Flying Dutchman.
And at this location, it's hundreds of years of folklore.
Yeah. Oh, it just builds.
Subconsciously,
and builds.
Are you telling me that's not coming up at all?
Whatever. I'm not telling you that. I agree with you 100%.
Why? This is weird.
I know, right?
This is the upside down.
Because almost unbelievably, that very night, he happened to glance starboard and was shocked to see a massive unlit ship headed right towards them. Now, according to Mudd, the ship was absolutely gigantic. It was also, as far as he could tell, close enough that he could throw a trumpet onto it. Those are his words. I don't know why he chose a trumpet. Maybe that's what he had.
Military.
And thirdly, the other thing that he noticed is that it moved completely silently and against the wind. Now, the giant ship moved closer and closer, and Mudd was too terrified to even scream, simply holding onto the railing for dear life in what was sure to be a collision set to sink both vessels, when suddenly a bolt of lightning doesn't just flash like it did in other ones. This idea of a flash of light is very well linked to the Dutchman. Other times it's said to have its own unearthly glow, as you might expect from a ghost ship. However, it's not just a bizarre and remote flash of lightning that causes a blinding effect and then boom, it's gone. This lightning goes in through the hatch and comes out the bow of the ship. And in that moment, the ship disappears. However, before it does, in that flash of light, he sees something that not a lot of other people have reported seeing, have even been close enough to see, much less, but he sees two figures within the ship. One of them is an anachronistically dressed man. He's dressed all in lace and velvet, and he looks like either a pirate or a very rich captain or something like that. The other figure is not a man. And the only thing that Mudd says about it is something about piercing eyes and a massive slippery thing. I like to think that it was Cthulhu. It sounds like
it's
some
made up monster.
It sounds like some kind of a monster, kind of a creature or a being. But he is very clear that whatever it was not a human being. The other human being may have been dead, but he was still a human being. This was no human being at all. And I think that this account probably directly influenced when they made Davy Jones and like in the Pirates of the Caribbean, as we've talked about multiple times, directly influenced like how he looks with his
tentacle face
and all of that, because that is kind of what it sounds like, piercing eyes and some sort of massive slipperiness with it. However, as the flash of light ended, so too did the apparition of the ship. But that wasn't the only time that the Dutchman would be spotted that evening, because that encounter took place around 6 p.m. About half an hour later, Mudd saw the ship again, this time passing by them with full sails, aided by some unearthly wind, because it was technically moving against like what the current should be, but there wasn't a lot of wind to begin with. This time, its sails were full as if there was a beautiful gale aiding them along. However, he was not alone. And in this case, he was there with the ship's quartermaster, a man named Olson, who also saw the ship and shouted, "Ship ahoy!" But within a split second, a flash of lightning took the ship again. Now, as with earlier accounts, we know at least that the people making them were real people who were really in the places that they said they were and the times that they said they were. Mudd's records have been apprehended from the archives of the Naval Academy. They show him as earning the title of cadet midshipman around September of 1875. And those are good stories because they really flesh out an archetype. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of stories about the Flying Dutchman, but I didn't want to get into all of those. I just wanted to do a few of them. And this is a great archetypal story. The ship appearing, the ship disappearing, the ship almost coming and hitting you. That's a very common one. But again, that portent of bad experience, that portent of doom. Now, it's not really known what exactly happened to the younger Mudd, the newer Mudd, J.A. Mudd. We don't really know if there was a great mutiny or if people got sick or if people died or whatever there. But one of the last, I think the last story that I have here is also one of the most enduring, quote-unquote, real-life tales. It did for the legend of the ghost ship in reality what Wagner's opera did for it as a legend itself and solidifying for it. And the witness in this case was somebody a lot higher up than a cadet midshipman. It was King George V of the islands of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, the Emperor of India, and grandfather of Queen Elizabeth II. Now, while he was traveling on his ship Bacchanate, on a route moving between Melbourne and Sydney in July 11th, 1881, a curious entry from the prince, he was the prince at the time, the prince's journal recounts an encounter with some ship that was witnessed by upwards of 13 people on board, and I'm just going to quote here from the King's Journal. July 11th at 4 a.m., the Flying Dutchman crossed our bows, a strange red light of a phantom ship all aglow in the midst of which light the masts, spars, and sails of a brig 200 yards distance stood out in strong relief as she came up on the port bow. The lookout man on the forecastle reported her as close on the port bow, where also the officer of the watch from the bridge clearly saw her, as did also the quarter-deck midshipman, who was sent forward at once to the forecastle. But on arriving there, no vestige nor any sign whatsoever of any material ship was to be seen, either near or right away to the horizon. The night being clear and the sea being calm, 13 persons altogether saw her, but whether it was Van Diemen or the Flying Dutchman, or who else, must remain unknown. The Tourmaline and Cleopatra, who were sailing on our starboard bow, flashed to ask whether we had seen the strange red light. At 6:15 a.m., observed land, Mount Diana, to the northeast. At 10:45 a.m., the ordinary seaman, who had this morning reported the Flying Dutchman, fell from the foretop mast, cross trees, onto the topgallant forecastle, and was smashed to atoms. At 4:15 p.m. after quarters, we have to, with the head yards aback, At 4:15 p.m. after quarters, we hove to, with the head yards aback, and he was buried in the sea. He was a smart royal yardman and one of the most promising young hands in the ship, and everyone feels quite sad at his loss. At the next port we came to, the admiral also was smitten down. Now, this reference that he makes about midway through to the Van Diemen is not 100% clear. There was another famous sailor, an Anthony Van Diemen, who was famous for his voyages to Australia in the 17th century, also implied by the Dutch East India Company. However, there hasn't been many, if any, reports of him literally haunting the passages of sea around Australia, and so the king's reference to him could be seen as a coy jest, which is how many people actually view and believe the intent of the king's reference to the Flying Dutchman itself was. Again, this took place in 1881, and so this was right about the time that, well, not right about, but after the opera was first performed. It was performed many, many times past that. There were stories and this and that, and basically it's believed that the king said the Flying Dutchman, not because he thought it was the Flying Dutchman, but just because he was trying to kind of make light of the situation. However, most people who believe in the Flying Dutchman, not that there's some sort of tribunal or anything like that, or not even believe, but want to believe in the Flying Dutchman, say that this was most likely a credible account. But again, it's phantom. It's in mist, and it's far off, and it's hard to say, and it's 4 a.m. And so it's impossible to say what is actually happening here for sure. But the other interesting thing is, again, the portent of doom. And it's hard to say because the sea is obviously a naturally dangerous place. I mean, you don't go to the sea to have a nice, long, happy, carefree life. But the first person to see the Dutchman falls and dies that very same day, just hours later. And then an admiral, also on the ship, supposedly was struck down at the next port, although we don't know how or why or anything like that. And again, I think that the idea of a ghost ship is crazy, but I don't know that I don't believe it. Especially with J.A. Mudd's stories, it's really easy to be like, oh, you were reading about it all day. Like, literally, as we did our humanoid special, like, guess what I saw all night? Humanoids. Yeah, they were everywhere.
Like usual.
It was terrible. And they've never left. But that is fine, but I really find this handwritten account, not even the main course of these letters, but just one thing to happen within them, to a famously tragic ship, the only ship to experience a mutiny that ended in hangings, like in the U.S. Navy. It at the very least makes for a good story. And I do believe that these people are seeing some sort of something. And to get to the bottom of what that something is, I've brought in a guy who likes to think that he's an expert sometimes.
I'm an enthusiast.
He's an enthusiast, and his name is Jason, and he's been fairly quiet for this episode. You've contributed a bit, okay. But I'd like to just turn the time over to you, because I know you've been biting your tongue. You do this sometimes when in the notes I make a specific point for you to rebut my claims. Sometimes you, like, bide your tongue until that point. So, go forth.
Okay. So, the Flying Dutchman and ghost ships in general. Okay. You calm down now, all right?
Okay.
This is actually a pretty well-observed phenomenon, and I'm sure you've probably come across it in your own research, of the Fata Morgana? Feta? Feta.
I think it's Fata Morgana.
See, I figured it'd be like Phantom.
I don't think they share a root.
It's Italian.
I think it has to do with Arthurian legend, doesn't it?
Yes, correct.
So I don't think it's Italian.
But the term itself is Italian.
Is it?
Yes, because a Jesuit priest from Sicily observed the phenomenon himself and named it after Morgan, who is Morgan King Arthur's, yes, half-sister, and also an enchantress and a fairy, which apparently led people to their doom. In some way or
sure,
form, which not? I need to do a little bit more research on myself.
Yeah, somebody said that we should cover King Arthur. I don't know if this is the right avenue for that, but I do love the stories, and I would like to learn more about them.
We've talked about weirder things, or like off basis things before.
But, I mean, I guess so. Okay, I'm gonna shut up now so Jason can talk. Anyway,
so the priest himself, he saw essentially a reflection in the sky of a city, and he could see individuals on the streets, and he realized that it really was something going on with the air above the sea. Now, we see something very similar all the time, especially on a hot summer day with asphalt. It's a little bit different. The reason why it's different is because with asphalt, it is about layers of heat and air. With asphalt, and also in, say, like a desert where mirages of oases exist, sort of, the bottom layer of air closest to the ground, or essentially, the horizon, we'll go ahead and say, is warmer than the air above it. What that does is cause a mirage that essentially mirrors something above it. So, in a desert, we see an oasis, because all it's actually doing is mirroring and reflecting the light from the sky itself, which makes it seem like there's water over there and leads people to their doom. Now, a Fata Morgana is a little bit different because instead of having a layer of warm air at the very, very bottom, it's a layer of cold air because the ocean and water in general is a really good insulator. It's really good at keeping temperatures pretty well regulated. So what happens is that you have a layer of essentially cold air at the very bottom, right above the sea. And then you have warmer air currents above it. What that actually does is reflect and refract light in different ways that we aren't used to seeing. Our eyes, whenever we see something, is essentially picking up thinking that is coming in a straight line. That's why every time you look down into a clear pool of water, if you put like your arm in there and it refracts differently, that is because our eyes are still trying to figure out what's going on, and it assumes that that ray of light is coming directly at us. Now, let's put that aside.
I don't know if I can.
going back to our priest in Sicily, he theorized that this weird mirage was being caused essentially by minerals in the water and salt evaporating into the air, and which would eventually condense and become clouds, and that is causing essentially a mirror effect. Not completely wrong. It's really just the differences in, again, air temperature and how light reacts to that. Now, once you turn to the scale of an ocean, it gets a lot more epic than what it looks like just on our streets with asphalt.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually able to essentially reflect and mirror things past our horizon line.
So does this phenomena disprove the flat Earth?
Sam, we don't speak of that.
Okay, all right, moving forward. I'm fine. I'm
anyway,
fine with that.
Yes, clearly, because flat earthers are silly. If you believe in the flat Earth, go read a textbook.
Jason,
go
I'm the one who has to read the emails.
God, I am so sorry that you can't figure this out.
You know what? I'm going to leave that in.
Good, because I am tired of the internet spreading misinformation. It is time to just buckle down, accept science for what it is, and move on with your life.
Fair.
There is also a bottom of the ocean. For those of you who know about the Reddit page that is all about figuring
Wait,
out
what?
Whether or not there's a bottom to the
Wait,
ocean,
what?
There is a
what
Reddit page.
What do you mean?
So
some people just think it's ocean all the way through?
We've never been to the bottom, but we have.
Haven't we?
Yes, we have.
There's just... Okay, whatever. This is
anyway,
stupid. This sounds stupid.
See? It's also stupid.
Okay.
So anyway...
Of course there's a bottom.
Going
Isn't
back to
that
our
like,
mirages.
Okay, no. Okay. But wait. I have heard that the crust of the Earth, including the ocean and mountains, is as relatively thin and smooth as the skin of an apple.
Or a cue ball or anything else. Yes.
Well, no, like the skin of the apple.
No.
That thinness is what the crust of the Earth is.
Oh, not the smoothness?
Well, the
sure.
smoothness as well, but... Yeah.
I mean, I do have the internet literally at my fingertips, but I don't know off the top of my head whether or not
so
that's
So this
correct.
Whole idea that, like, we've never been to the bottom of the ocean is stupid.
It is.
Okay.
It is incredibly stupid.
I hate
Just like flat earthers.
They're probably the same people.
I wouldn't
Have you
be
heard of this hot new conspiracy theory that birds aren't real?
What?
We'll talk about it later. Go ahead.
Okay, so anyway... The Flying Dutchman is just a fata morgana. That's all it
Wait,
is.
But the last
now,
thing you said was something about how when we're at sea, this
yes.
gets even more epic because something about beyond our horizons. And then
right,
I
right,
said...
Right, right, because it's completely open space and you have that layer of cool air for a much farther expanse. So, and with the curvature of the Earth, it essentially becomes almost like a lens factor to it. It is...
So
apparently incredibly
cool.
Does
disprove
now,
flat Earth.
It does.
Nice.
And also, to get the conditions just right is extremely, extremely rare.
Yeah, I would say that probably the vast majority of people will never see this happen. Is that fair?
True.
Okay.
Absolutely. But when it does, usually it precedes a big storm.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh,
so
really?
These happen more frequently when we are at a location where you have, two oceans meeting. We have a flux of different temperatures, different currents happening at the same time. So areas of higher storms are pretty used to having these different layerings of hot and cold air moving back and forth. And that also creates the turbulence that will become a storm later on. So the idea that we see this ship off into the distance that is floating higher even than what the horizon line is, or is magnified to this great big scale out of nowhere, that doesn't make sense to us for being there, is really a reflection in a hypermagnification of a ship beyond our horizon line. So we don't know where
don't
it's coming
even
from.
See it.
You don't. You can't. And then we have this connection of impending doom from a heavy storm because, again, these conditions occur right before a storm hits most of the time. And I've went to a few different websites in order to get this. The one that I pulled most of this information on has been from Wired, which I don't know how anyone feels about that. But I've double-checked it on a few other sites. And even when you look at the Wikipedia page for Fata Morgana, states Flying Dutchman.
Oh, sure.
Like, it is one of the telltale, like, obvious examples of this
sure.
crazy mirage that we just get fooled by because of the way that light works,
yeah.
which is cool.
But what about the slimy thing? What about the slimy thing, Jason?
We are very imaginative okay, species. And we are very, very open to...
Maybe it's a Fata Morgana of an octopus.
And we're very open to suggestion.
That's fair. That's fair. That's what you got.
That's what I got.
That was very sciencey.
And again, like, it isn't just to ships. Like, you can do this. This happens every once in a while, like I was saying in Sicily, where you see the city mm-hmm. that you're at, or a neighboring city, and you can see the people. There was an incident on, I believe it was one of the Great Lakes, where you were able to count the church. What are the pinnacles of the towers called?
Steeples?
Sure. You can That's count the steeples, even though that church was 50 miles away and out of our normal view. Because of the way that this crazy air pressure, temperature, and light works. It's insane.
And, of course, we've talked about the Fata Morgana before when we talked about Hybrasil back in May of 2017.
God, so long
ago.
That
was an interesting, weird episode. It's giant rabbits and warlocks and stuff. But essentially, probably the same thing happening, the reflection of light. And that one was interesting because it was an entire island that appeared and disappeared.
Yeah, I think one thing that sets the Flying Dutchman apart is that there is no physical contact.
Right, right.
And this eerie kind of ghostly apparition feel to it makes a lot more sense in that regard, being a trick of the eye.
Is there anything inherent in the way that a Fata Morgana works that you can think of that would cause the Dutchman to be surrounded with a glow? Or on the other side, because if you don't have a glow, it's typically from afar you have a glow. Okay. If it's close up, it's completely dark, and you just see the structure of the thing, and everybody says there's no lights inside of it, that sort of a thing. So for either one of those, either that could cause an unnatural glow or that could extinguish the natural glow of something.
So my initial thought is probably embellishment of the story.
Yeah, sure.
Secondly,
but that's why
for,
I'm
for some sort of glow,
with that.
I wouldn't also be surprised if it's some sort of weird shine effect that is occurring mm-hmm. on the actual ship that is producing the eventual reflection,
sure,
if that makes sense.
Sure.
If there is some sort of weird thing hitting them as well. Because like I said, this is an incredibly like rare mm-hmm. occurrence that happens, and it happens more often in open water. But that being said, we aren't necessarily sailing at that level any longer. Well, we are, but they're giant cargo ships. It's not full crews that are essentially just peering off into the open ocean forever. And I really don't think it, for the most part, like there's, as far as science is concerned, this is the unfortunate thing about science is that there's no money
in explaining exactly those. How a Fata Morgana works.
Yeah, right? we've got a good enough explanation for what it is. We don't need to put more research into that, more money into it. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, some of the more interesting things that aren't like need to know facts
don't get the
funding.
Sure. I have an idea.
And the attention.
And it is an idea that goes in line with this because I'm fine with saying that it is a Fata Morgana. A little part of me thinks it could be a ghost ship. That's fine. The spirit of a vessel merged with the spirit of a man, wandering the seas until judgment. But
it's a phenomenal story.
It's one of the better stories in the world, I would say. But so thunder, okay, is not thunder the contraction of air because of the heat of a lightning bolt? Isn't that what it is?
Well, it's a sound wave, which...
But it's made from the air contracting.
Sure. I don't know.
I'm pretty
sure
that's right.
The actual science behind it. I wouldn't be surprised because that would create some sort of sound wave mm-hmm. as well.
And so if this all has to do with like layers of air...
Or the opposite. Because lightning is just energy, essentially.
Sure. But, so, but very like, hot.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
It superheats the air around.
Right, right. Which would make me assume that air is getting pushed out.
Right.
Kind of like breaking the sound barrier.
I'm sure somebody knows this. Let us know. Yeah. Let us know. But if it's doing either of those things, either contracting the air. Yeah, the clap of thunder
or whatever.
Yeah, either contracting or expanding the air. Expanding does sound right. But in any case, could it be that this disturbance of the air is what takes this highly specialized condition for the Fata Morgana to appear with the cold air and the warm air and this, and shatters it so that whenever this ship is disappearing, it's almost always with a bolt of lightning and a clap of thunder.
So I think I would assume both the thunder, the lightning, and the disappearance are all probably byproducts of the storm.
Right.
Right. I don't think it's necessarily, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's probably the lightning or the thunder that is causing the mirage to dissipate.
Okay.
I'm assuming those are all byproducts of what the storm is doing, because all lightning bolt is essentially you got enough electrons in clouds to polarize, and then it has to balance itself out somehow, which creates the lightning bolt down to a surface of some sort, typically the ground or whatever the highest point is. I'd expect, because the movement of the electrons from warmer or the colder air, that process is probably something that interacts and eventually leads to the lightning as well. So I wouldn't be surprised if at first you have the mirage,
mm-hmm.
and then the mirage slowly starts to dissipate, and then you have the lightning from a storm. I wouldn't be surprised if it's that flow of electrons that is starting to cause the disappearance and then the appearance of lightning.
Cool. All
but right. I'm not a meteorologist. Not I'm an scientist. Enthusiast.
There we go. He's an enthusiast.
I'm excited about it. I know little. I'm making mostly guesses.
I know little. May know lot. Thank you. That was very enlightening. I know we talked about it before. I think that was even better. And even more in depth. I don't know. I know that you've just told me an explanation that explains every aspect of this. But I just can't not believe in a ghost ship. I don't know why. It's ingrained in me. I have to.
Well, have you seen, what is it?
Pirates of the Caribbean?
No, I was thinking Blue Planet or the one, like the planet Earth, but about the oceans. Have you seen that one?
The ocean is a very scary place.
But have you seen about like the birds dive bomb and fish into the waters?
That may have been in Planet Earth.
That might have been Planet Earth. Apparently, their brains anticipate and autocorrect for the refraction of light through water.
See? And our stupid human brain can't even do that.
I don't understand, like,
a bird has a better brain than me.
Figured it out. Birds have been around for much longer than we have.
Sure, they were
birds
dinosaurs.
Yeah,
I know.
Okay. That's all I got. That was my fun fact.
And a fun fact.
I just wanted to get us off that topic so that we can end things.
Yes. And here we are at the end of all things. And I'm glad to be here with you.
We did
it. Samwise Gamgee.
Wait, what?
That's from Lord of the Rings.
Yo, I know. he's not here.
Aren't I? In any case, yes, we are at the end of this, what was going to be an hour, a tight hour. And instead, we're at an hour
it's
and
loose.
40 minutes.
It's very loose.
We'll probably be about an hour and 20 once all is said and done. But in any case, we're so glad you've spent your time with us. We're so happy that you've come on this voyage across the deadly sea to arrive here on the shores of wisdom and scientific knowledge. Forsaking the superstition of the old and leaving me back there and coming along with Jason. And if you didn't,
I was really impressed, and now I figured out how much of a ramble that was.
I'm so happy that you've stayed here with me on the banks of the mighty river of superstition, where we will patiently
we didn't talk
await
about any rivers.
Patiently await the arrival of the Dutchman to take us home to meet our maker. In any case, thank you for spending time with us. And now we have to do some thanking of other people too. So we went ahead and we skipped like a few weeks, or not a few weeks, like a week. So we have a few people we want to thank for submitting great reviews. We actually didn't have any 1 stars pop up this week. So that,
man, those are my favorite.
I know, they're so good. So we want to thank.
It's like golf, right? You need lower the better.
No.
Oh.
No. We want to thank Lazel. We want to thank Aurora 2000. We want to thank T Bents. We want to thank Lee Girl 33. And we want to thank, what would Odin do?
Probably something very wrathful.
Something with nature and its forces. I don't know. He'd give his eye for wisdom and hang himself as a sacrifice to himself, which is like the best thing. But we're going to read that one, not only because I love the Odin that you're bringing to the table, but also because their review, and at this point, maybe we're just being petty, but their review says, back it up, 1 star reviewers. That's the title.
I love how you're the one that picks these out all the time. They're great.
And I just want to say,
you're inciting this. You realize that, right?
I am. And I just want to say that I appreciate this review for what it is. And this is what it is. Do the guys always get the facts straight?
Truth.
Does Jason often know what the topic will be prior to does Jason often know what topic will be discussed prior to recording?
I used to.
Not usually. But guess what? And this is something I really do want to drill home. This isn't that kind of podcast. This is one of the few podcasts where I genuinely laugh out loud while listening, and it's worth more than all the 1-star reviews in this haunted multiverse. So thank you. What would Odin do? I love that review because I, as the one who mans the email account, I have gotten letters, not a lot of them, some of them, that call for the removal of either one of us. They're like, Sam has no sense of humor. Sam does terrible accents. Sam is not funny. Sam doesn't do his research right. And then other people who are like, Jason makes terrible jokes. Jason doesn't bring anything to the conversation. Jason doesn't do his research. We have both been called, like, people who straight up are like, fire that person, either one of us. And it's like, that's not this podcast. You're looking for something else. So please go aboard the Flying Dutchman
and
into the other world. So anyway, Sam,
it's just a mirage. They're stepping out of nothing but thin air.
That's what I'm hoping.
Oh.
Into the ocean. To Davy Jones's locker. All right.
Let's get out of that plank again.
Yeah, well, plank it up. I don't know
what that means. What is this, 2010?
It's 9:40. I want to go to bed.
Doing planks again?
Planking it. So yeah, thank you for everybody who knows what this show is and loves it for that. I don't mean to be petty. That's going to be like the last time we talk about 1-star reviews unless somebody leaves one this week. So we'll see. But
sounds about right.
The other people that we really want to thank and really, I mean, are super just extremely grateful to are all of the people who have become patrons of ours in the last 2 weeks. I don't remember where I ended, as often happens when we take a 1 week break. So there might be some overlap here. But we'd like to thank Keen Dilemma.
Woo!
Keen! We'd like to thank Taylor Nauvoo.
Taylor!
We'd like to thank Yale Gammon.
Yale
Gammon.
Like the school.
Sure.
That I didn't get accepted to.
You didn't apply to Yale, did
I
you?
I didn't, no.
Okay.
You kidding me? I wouldn't get accepted.
That's fair. Maybe one day we'll have a meetup. But today we'd like to thank Julia. All right.
Yeah, Julia.
We'd like to thank Dylan Hertel.
Woo, Dylan.
We'd like to thank Zachary Suffern.
All right, Zachary.
And we would like to thank Janann Ferguson. All right, thank you so much, Janann. But it's a Ferguson, you know. That's a Scotsman.
I don't know what that means.
That's a Scotsman if I've ever heard one.
Okay.
My dad told me that I'm actually really Scottish, like not doing good Scottish accents, but he heard me talking about it, that we actually have a lot more Scottish than I thought, but we are also very Danish. So I wonder if that's just part of, I want to do one of those 23andMe things, but not that one because they sell your genetic information. Yeah, they do.
Well,
don't do 20. Well, wait, no, this is libel now if I'm wrong. I don't think I am.
I think I heard something a little like interesting about that. I don't really remember exactly what it was. Like slightly scandalous, But don't you still pay for it?
Yeah.
That's weird. Usually, like, people sell, like, stuff in general to, like, I'm thinking, like, Facebook-level stuff where, like, ooh, we know your information. Yeah. Let's sell it for ads.
This is your literal genetic genome.
That's fine.
No, it's not.
I want there to be more of me.
Anyway, I know that Nat Geo does one. I know that there's like Ancestry really, that does one. So I'd like to do one of those sometimes. But in any case,
do it.
Sorry if I offended you for being Scottish. We really do appreciate your contribution to the show. And because of all of the wonderful contributions that keep the light on, not only do we have a record number of lights, because there's an additional one that we don't usually have, but also that light went out last week, and we were able to fix it and get it back on. So we have, I'm going to estimate, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, probably 8 lights on. And all because
they're so wasteful of energy.
Well, it's almost 10 o'clock at night. So all because of the patrons keeping that going. So thank you so much. If you'd like to learn how to become a patron, you can go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast. There you can get unedited early access to episodes of the show, usually at least one, if not like this week, it'll probably be 2 or 3 days early. You can get our bonus episodes, and you can really just help out. And say thanks for, well, now this sounds conceited. Say thanks for all we do for you, but that's not what I mean. Just say you find value in the work we do, which we appreciate. But if you can't write a review, that's fine. If you can't donate on Patreon, that's fine. Especially with the holidays, we understand. If you'll just go out, tell somebody about the podcast, that'll do wonders by itself. But even if you can't do that, because you don't want people to think
you're... You should probably describe what it is before saying, hey, I know this spooky podcast. Yeah. Let's be perfectly
make
clear
sure that they know
are.
Who we are, and that I'm not going to fire Jason, and that Jason doesn't have the power to fire me.
I could just walk away.
That's true. Don't.
I don't with the ship.
I don't love to see you walk away, and I don't love to see you leave.
That's so sweet of you.
Yes. Anyway, even if you can't do any of that, and we cannot stress enough, make sure that people know what they're coming in for. But just you listening to the show is enough, and is enough of a thanks to us. It means the world to us that people listen to this at all. So thank you so much for being our friends and our listeners. We'll be back next week with a subject that I really hope it turns out well. I've got big plans for it, and I'm really excited for it.
And I won't know what it is until next Wednesday.
Pretty much. Until then, you can find us on Facebook at Jason's just like, let's go. You can find us at notalonepodcast.com. You can find us on Facebook at Not Alone Podcast, or remember, we are not alone, a community for the strange. You can find me, or you can find the show on Facebook at Not Alone Pod. You can find me at Beer Lord Elfbane, and you can find Jason at
Mighty Moit.
Mighty Moit. Until next time, remember, whether you enjoy a luxury cruise with your family, or you find yourself falling from the crow's nest in the middle of a storm, looking in the eyes of some great slippery thing, you are
not alone.